This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone, to yet another episode of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z. I'm Matt Fonslow, and I should do a movie quote, but I'm not. I'm going to introduce my guest, Margaret Light. You've maybe heard of her before. She's been on the podcast once, maybe twice. Okay, like half a dozen times. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She is also the president. Okay, according to her, the owner of Equilibrium Therapy Services. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being on. And before we get rolling too quickly here, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Napa Auto Tech Training and Pico Technology. Let Napa Auto Tech's Build a Tech program, you know, like Build-A-Bear, help you turn your general technician into a moneymaker for your shop. Make them a profitable member of your team. Go to NapaAutoTech.com for more details. Are you chasing elusive automotive problems? Pico Technology empowers you to see what's really happening. Pinpoint faults in sensors, wiring, and components with unmatched accuracy. Picoscope oscilloscopes transform your diagnostic capabilities. Visit PicoAuto.com, that's PicoAuto.com, and revolutionize your diagnostics today.
Thank you for having me back.
Thank you again for being on and putting up with a lot of my BS, would be putting it kindly.
Shortcomings.
Which I have many, if I were to quote Rhett Butler. Yeah, that is a character from Gone with the Wind. For those of you that don't know, Gone with the Wind is a old movie everyone should watch, but just keep in mind, slavery wasn't as good as they depicted it.
True. Thank you for that disclaimer.
Will you be watch it? I have the disclaimer on before you get to watch it, so that it's hard to forget. Anyways, you pitched a really, really good idea for an episode. When you sent it, my initial reaction was to make a joke, which showed a misunderstanding that I think, and I don't mean this in defense of myself, I just think in general, too, in the general populace, that we have a big misunderstanding about psychosis and psychopathy.
Yes.
And I had made a joke about psychosis, almost like, you know, serial killers, sociopaths, stuff like that. But that's not what you were talking about at all.
That's true.
I mean, for the sake of the audience, could you please explain where I went awry with that knee-jerk response of mine to try to be funny and fail?
So it's either a loss of contact with reality, or it's when a person struggles to differentiate between what's real and what's not. Psychopathy or sociopathy or antisocial personality disorder, while some of those terms sound similar, what that refers to is this ongoing pattern of behavior where somebody violates the rights of others and displays a lack of empathy. So they're actually completely different.
Yeah. I'm thinking, just like off the cuff, an example might have been for what you're talking about. The break from reality was a somewhat public struggle of a movie director named Kevin Smith, where he had to go, I think he went to inpatient to try to get back because he did have a very major break from reality. I think his, and I don't want to steer this at all. Like I really want the ball to be in your court and to kind of go in the direction you would like. But I feel like my understanding of his break was driven very, very hard by a big or an extreme level of imposter syndrome, where Kevin Smith, the person, wasn't the Kevin Smith that he was acting like and being thought of as by the general populace. And that was my understanding of it. That was the drive that sent him in a, I don't even want to say like a dark way, just with that break.
I guess I can't comment on that just because I'm not familiar with sort of that event. When I talk about psychosis and loss of contact with reality, our hallmark is one or more of the following five symptoms. And so I think that'll probably paint a better picture of what is psychosis in a clinical sense. So it's a combination, one or more of the following, of delusions, which I'll define in a minute, hallucinations, disorganized thinking, grossly disorganized or abnormal behavior and what we call negative symptoms. And so that's a lot of clinical language that we should probably break down one by one.
And not to push this again or accelerate it at all, but my guess is the first thing popping into the listener's head, or for sure mine, jumping up and down, is schizophrenia.
Yes. So you're exactly right there. So the way we kind of think about it is there's these class of disorders, schizophrenia spectrum and other psychotic disorders is sort of the general class. And then there's a whole bunch of disorders that fit into that class, of which schizophrenia is one, but not the only one. So those tend to be the disorders people are most familiar with when we think about psychotic symptoms. But the reality is psychotic symptoms can actually show up in a variety of places. So OCD can look like psychotic symptoms, but it isn't. Bipolar disorder can include psychosis, depression. Drug use can look like psychosis or even induce it. You know, normally prescribed certain types of medication can trigger psychosis. It can be related to medical conditions or postpartum, so after somebody gives birth, and then also neurodevelopmental disorders. So that's like autism, developmental delays, things like that. So it isn't unique to this family of psychotic disorders, but that tends to be what we think about most when we think about it.
Again, with a little bit of fear of derailing this or going off on a tangent, but you've used the word psychotic now multiple times. And I think just as kids, as adults, online, watching exchanges, people refer to someone as being, you're psychotic. Using it in such a way that's not accurate whatsoever as to what they're pointing out, whatever behavior, whatever somebody typed, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. I've seen that too. And I think that's actually part of why I pitched the idea, is because I saw some things playing out where clearly there's just like this massive lack of information and understanding about what is this language clinically? What does it actually mean? And then what are the realities associated with this phenomenon? Because yes, right, when we're sort of calling one another psychotic just out in the general populace, it is never used in an accurate way.
I probably should have researched this. I don't know where it stemmed from, you know? I suppose the knee-jerk reaction would be the movie's kind of series, Psycho. But that's just the very beginning. It never went to psychotic.
I would argue part of it comes probably from stigma in terms of these class of disorders and this kind of symptomology is really feared. And then there's also a lot of stigma around what does it mean to struggle with this? Who struggles with this? How common is it? And then when we continue to use language like that, it really perpetuates some of these myths about what does this mean? How do people think when they're experiencing this? And then there's this level of shame when we're using it in this way, which just actually makes the shame associated with the actual clinical disorders even worse.
Yeah, we got to get shame in whenever we can. Is that a U.S. thing, or is the pretty much the entire planet kind of got that covered?
I mean, probably the entire planet. And it's also a function, I think, of misinformation, too.
There's a few generations, I think, shame worked. Meaning, like, for a few generations of it, it worked for controlling behavior and disciplining and that. And then now we're feeling the repercussions.
I don't know if I agree with that. I'm going to go super literal for a minute. If we think about the way shame is used to control behavior, this is what a lot of families will do if, let's say, an adolescent starts displaying some of these symptoms, is there can be a lot of shaming around it and a lot of fear. And actually, it does nothing to control that behavior. It just creates all this inner turmoil. For people who maybe are dealing with things they have control over, shame can be a way to control behavior. But if it's something you don't functionally have control over, it's actually massively ineffective.
Yeah, and I think that's where I was aiming the comment at, is more of a, I hate the word normal. Normal's not, but if I mean normal by maybe the masses and certain, just for the sake of conversation, criteria that those of you not watching the video, quote unquote, worked, and then after a multiple generations of it, it's starting to backfire. It's not such a strong ploy. It's maybe easy. Again, I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but just with having a child with ADHD or symptoms of ADHD, shame won't work. It doesn't work. It will make things worse. So I would say, albeit he is not perfectly well adjusted yet, I think he's on the way, and maybe won't be perfect, but on his way to being more in control. The environment that we have him in has been the biggest benefit to it. But now to get back on track for another 3 minutes until I get us back off track. And then,
all right, so let's talk about delusions. And I'm going to define it clinically for a minute, because this is another term we hear a lot. That's delusional. So let's talk about it. So delusions are, I'm going to just quote clinical language, fixed beliefs that are not amenable to change in light of conflicting evidence. And so then we classify them into either bizarre or non-bizarre. Lots of people aren't going to like this language, but I'm pulling this directly out of the DSM. So here we are. Bizarre delusions are not possible. So for example, if somebody believes aliens came down and removed all my organs and put somebody else's organs inside of me, that would be considered a bizarre delusion, right? That is not possible. A non-bizarre delusion is something that's possible, but there's no evidence for. So I'm being monitored by the government. If there's no evidence for that, right, technically possible, but there's no evidence. Delusions can be, even clinically, kind of difficult to sort out from what's a delusion versus what's a strongly held belief. And that's where I think we see this conversation culturally is, people will have difference of opinion or belief and say that's delusional. Well, is it? Strongly held belief or delusion, right? Like there's a whole discussion there. Part of what how we differentiate between the two is, what is the degree of conviction somebody holds that this belief is accurate, despite kind of clear or reasonable evidence to the contrary, accounting for culture, and does it impair their life? And some of this is a little gray, because sometimes what we would consider delusional in one culture wouldn't be delusional in another. So, right, there's a lot of gray there, but broadly, that's how we think about delusion. So that's one of our symptoms of psychosis. Our second are hallucinations. These are a lot more clear and I think easy to grasp, because they're these perception-like experiences that occur without an external stimulus. So any of your senses, right? Seeing, hearing, tasting, feeling, smelling, things that are not there. Hallucinations can operate on a spectrum though. So sometimes they're very, very mild, which is maybe seeing shadows that don't exist, which is actually really, really common. All the way to, I see people, places, things, people are grabbing me, which isn't really happening, right? Like that's the farther side of that spectrum. So our third one is disorganized thinking, which is evidenced in speech. So that would be speech that's either incomprehensible or sometimes what people will call word salad, where people are saying actual words, but they're not in any sort of order that makes sense. It just sounds random. Yes, right. Houses has some good kind of demonstrations of this, actually. And again, right, this is another thing that occurs on a spectrum of, sometimes it's just sprinkled in there occasionally, and so you can still kind of understand them. Sometimes it's, oh, it's this really tangential stuff that doesn't actually make sense. So, you know, the stoplight turned red, and then my grandma died, and that happened because the stoplight turned red, right? Like, it's just like, that's not tracking. Our fourth one is this, what we call this grossly disorganized or abnormal behavior. And broadly, we consider this problems in any form of goal-directed behavior. And so that could be unpredictable agitation. It could be kind of childlike behavior coming from an adult. It could include what we call stereotyped movements, so repetitive movements, echoing of speech. And then the far end of that spectrum would be what we call catatonia, which again is a spectrum in and of itself, but it's essentially this delayed or decreased reactivity to the environment. And on the far end of that, we're talking about someone, we've maybe seen it in movies depicting schizophrenia, right, where someone is right catatonic, they're just literally unresponsive to the world around them. And again, this is another symptom that doesn't just occur in schizophrenia. And then our final one are negative symptoms, which is essentially diminished emotional expression. So maybe they're not expressive in the face, maybe there's not nonverbals that convey emotion, diminished speech, diminished ability to experience pleasure, lack of interest in social interactions, right? There's all type of stuff with there. And so broadly, it's those five things that make up this idea of what is psychosis or a psychotic disorder.
NAPA AutoTech training sessions are being conducted day and night in a town near you. This training caters to every level within your organization, be it a mechanical assistant, a mechanical specialist, a technology specialist, or a driver safety calibration specialist. Imagine a one-stop shop training partner in NAPA AutoTech that will lead your team to a path to greatness. AutoTech's entry-level Build-A-Tech classes convert the untapped potential of your new hires into money-making mechanical specialists. AutoTech's higher-level tech update classes introduce specialists to the world of ever-changing technologies, which prevents your shop from getting technologically stagnant. Remember, if you're not moving forward, you're falling behind. And, turning to the front of the store, the AutoTech Service Advisor class is an awesome way to hone your client advocate skill set, ultimately benefiting the customer through an improved vehicle repair experience. But it doesn't stop there. Imagine an electric vehicle class that takes your specialist well past the mundane, yet necessary, safety topics. Well, it's here. AutoTech's EV Ready Training is a week-long curriculum that takes participants through a hands-on experience involving hybrids and electric vehicles. The session kicks off with the use of PPE and proper tooling while touching on required OSHA regulations. Then, the students dive into the lab vehicles to gain knowledge of the common high-voltage components on EV and hybrid vehicles and their function. Attendees will be taken on a path exposing them to different electric vehicle manufacturers to compare component form and location. Additionally, information about Level 1 and Level 2 charging systems will be included, along with a quick look at DC to DC charging. The operation and maintenance of subsystems are explored, including the different modes of Tesla operations, and so much more. So what are you waiting for? Commit to taking your business to the next level with NAPA AutoTech Training. Electric and hybrid vehicles are here, and with them, a new era of diagnostics. Don't get left behind. Pico Technologies EV Diagnostic Kits are your all-in-one solution to safely and efficiently service any electric or hybrid vehicle. From comprehensive high-voltage system analysis and insulation testing to guided step-by-step procedures, Pico puts the power of confident repairs right at your fingertips. Future-proof your shop, boost your efficiency, and become the go-to expert for the next generation of cars. Visit PicoAuto.com today. That's PicoAuto.com. If you're laying in bed and you have a chair that has some shirts or clothes laying over it, and then it kind of looks like a monster, that may not technically be hallucinating because it is dark. There is something there. You're just reconstructing something that probably really isn't there.
Right. Correct. There is a difference there. Yeah. And it's important to know some people experience hallucinations as they fall asleep. There's actually a different name for that. Those are not considered hallucinations in the form of psychosis. That's an entirely different sleep-related thing.
So where do we go from here? Do we start taking that and looking at ourselves to be able to pick up on if we're starting to have these symptoms or alternatively other people?
Let's talk about how it actually just shows up in people in general, maybe to start with. Like I said earlier, most of these symptoms can occur on a spectrum. And the reality is lots and lots and lots of people with these type of symptoms on a regular basis, and you don't know about it. So a lot of what's depicted in media are absolute worst case scenarios, or they're majorly dramatized. And so when I was kind of prepping for this, I did a little research to try and figure out like, what are some cultural beliefs around this or what's not? And I think one of the beliefs I keep running into is there's this belief that people experiencing these symptoms are at an increased risk for harming you, right? They're dangerous. And even when I hear folks kind of talk about this, a lot of times the advice I see is people saying, well, protect yourself, carry a gun, this, that, or the other thing. But here's the actual numbers on it. Out of all the serious mental illnesses, which, right, these psychotic disorders would be considered part of that, but not the only one, only 3 to 5% of violent acts can be attributed to those illnesses. And within that, or sort of people who experience severe mental illness, the reality is they're actually more than 10 times more likely to be a victim of a violent crime than the general populace is. And so that's why I say lots of people live with this and we never know about it. Now, if you're experiencing this or you know someone who is, there can be a variety of insight into these symptoms. So again, right, best case scenario is somebody notices these things are happening and they're distressed by it or they're worried about it. And then they want to seek help, right? They want to be evaluated by a doctor or a mental health professional. But there is a phenomenon where somebody who's experiencing these symptoms or maybe on the farther end of this spectrum is not aware that these symptoms aren't reality. Then they believe it's truly happening and then they don't seek help or are resistant to help. And that's where things for families and individuals get a lot more complicated.
To be sympathetic or try to really understand it, that's the reality. That's if you're telling me the sky is blue and I'm telling you, no, you're delusional, it's some other color. Even if I'm technically right, which obviously I'm not, but that's about the level of trying to convince someone what they're seeing, hearing, thinking is not reality.
Correct. And I think that brings us to maybe like the first tip I give people, right? If you're confronted with someone who is saying or doing or believing something that fundamentally isn't true, it is not in your or their best interest to try and convince them that they're wrong. Like, that is not the answer. If you're confronted with somebody who's struggling with this, the answer is to slow down, listen, and validate. And you can validate something without saying, yes, this is true. Right. So if somebody shows up in my office and says, hey, the cable guy is part of a government conspiracy to track my whereabouts, my answer is not going to be, no, he's not. My answer is, oh my gosh, that sounds really scary.
And that goes back to like the relationship episode. And I should say episodes that we've done that comes up often. Validation isn't necessarily agreeing, it's kind of like leading with, it's easier said than done, darn it. I'm working on it, but leading with curiosity and validation rather than, you know, firing a look at them like, no.
Well, right. And it requires us to kind of have the impulse control to recognize, hey, this is not a moment where I need to just say what I think, right? This is maybe a moment to stop. Or what I tell my clients, pause, just pause. Don't do anything.
Yeah, it's probably a good practice anyways. Not that this would ever happen, but that's a tactic by people. If they want to manipulate you, that they lead with statements. They don't ask questions. They lead with statements. So like not that this is for anyone to really go do, but just as a thought experiment, challenge yourself to learn how much somebody earns at a store. Go to Target and just challenge yourself to find out what one of the employees there makes per hour without asking a single question and see if you can do it in under 5-10 minutes. Well, you end up making statements and it's playing on exactly what you're talking about. And I've kind of steered us off track again. So
I guess, yeah, I don't know where you're going with that.
But the need to state your position, your perspective, or correct something. That's playing on that need. So, hey, you know, I read this article where marriage counselors, they make like $250,000 a year. And you might be like,
tell me where.
Right. You might be a horrible candidate for this, but a lot of others would be like, yeah, right. That's what I read. So you're telling me the way I'm hearing this is not true. And then you might let slip like, yeah, I make half of that or whatever. But it's playing on that need. And so I guess the reason I brought it up is that everybody fights that desire, or a lot of us, everybody, that's blanket statements. Lots of us struggle with that desire to correct. So do you see those three people over there? They're looking at me. What three people? There's no three people over there. What's wrong with you? There's not three people over there. And so this need to correct.
Yeah. And I think especially for folks who are in a line, being correct matters a lot, right? That instinct is reinforced. And so, again, if you're confronted with someone struggling with this, right, your best response is, oh my gosh, tell me about that. Or I'm so glad you told me. Or, oh, that sounds terrible. Like some type of empathy.
Yeah. And more than just that situation. But yeah, absolutely. To be, have that awareness to respond like that. That's really good advice. Just that could be a blanket statement or a blanket advice to kind of lead with that.
And I think the other thing I sort of think about is, and this is true in a lot of scenarios, but it is definitely true in this scenario, right? If we're talking about someone who's experiencing psychotic symptoms, there can be a lot of anxiety and a lot of pressure for the person who's interacting with them, and this sense of like, we need to fix this and resolve this now. And that may not be true or even possible, right? And so I think there's a piece there about we need to be able to tolerate our own feelings long enough to be effective, right? And obviously there's going to be a very big difference between someone who discloses, hey, you know, I was diagnosed with schizophrenia in my early 20s. I take medication for it. I have a psychiatrist. I want you to know this is just a thing that happens for me sometimes, right? Like that is not a crisis versus, I mean, right, we're in Minnesota. If it's 20 below and somebody walks into Quick Trip in nothing but shorts and is talking about the aliens coming to abduct them, okay, we're probably in a crisis scenario now. And so we need to be able to modulate our response to that a little.
Is that one where we're not going to help them, but somebody could call for help? I don't know if it's always the best situation for the law enforcement to show up, but that's who's probably going to show up, because who else is going to show up other than maybe law enforcement with some EMTs, but is that where you engage them in conversation? And again, I'm not trying to imply like reason with them or anything like that, but give them the time of day, validate. And is that a situation for that? Assuming, and I don't want to push a stereotype because like you said, they're much more apt to have violence performed on them rather than them being violent with someone else, unless you're cornering them, of which now it has nothing to do with the mental health specifically. It's an actual human response. Is this an opportunity to do something like that?
First things first, when we sort of think about these symptoms, it can be context dependent what flags for us. So here's what I mean by that. Because we're in Minnesota, this is a really easy example, right? If somebody walks into Quick Trip and it's 90 degrees out and they're in shorts, it's probably not going to flag for us, right? We're like, eh, it's hot. They probably want you to wear a shirt, but like really no one cares. That person could totally be experiencing these symptoms and it would never flag for us. What's different is if it's 20 below and somebody walks in with nothing but shorts, that looks very different. Now, if this is happening randomly with a stranger, it is very appropriate to either check on them or call for help, whatever you're comfortable with. And so in most places, that's either going to be 911 or some type of crisis line. The reality is, though, we're pretty unlikely to be confronted with a stranger experiencing these symptoms. We're more likely to be confronted with a friend or a family member or a coworker or someone like that. And that's the place where I think we can really lean into the relationship of, right, I'm so glad you told me. That sounds really scary. I really want to help you with this, but you can leave help broad, right? The piece I'll say is like a mental health professional. So I used to work in an emergency department, right, where when 911 was called or crisis was called, folks were brought to me and then I did the assessment. What do we do now? And so the laws vary state to state, but as a general statement, at least in Minnesota, and I know a lot, most other states are like this, the criteria for being able to involuntarily treat someone for a mental health issue is pretty stringent. And so I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there about, hey, if someone is displaying these symptoms, it means they have to have mental health treatment and that they would qualify for involuntary treatment if they didn't sign up for it. And that's actually not the reality. So usually our criteria for involuntary treatment is harm to self or others, or they've lost the ability to care for themselves. So if somebody has some delusional beliefs, but is still able to go to work, buy groceries, care for themselves, they're not going to meet criteria for involuntary treatment. So that's a very different process than if somebody is having so many of these symptoms, they're not eating, they're going out inappropriately dressed in a way that would be dangerous for them, right? That would be evidence of, okay, actually, truly, you cannot care for yourself now. So when we think about like, how do we intervene on this? The kind of advice I give people is you're always allowed to call for help. And people can get discouraged because they believe if I call for help once, and the person isn't forced to stay, it means the system either doesn't work or will never force them to stay. But that's not reality. Sometimes the system has to be alerted multiple times, hey, there's a problem, or hey, the problem has gotten worse, right? I've totally worked cases where the first time I see someone, they can still care for themselves. And 3 days later, they've deteriorated to the point where they can't send them back.
Like you're saying, the terms I would be familiar with, I think, in this situation is creating a paper trail. And kind of like when we were talking about the domestic violence, creating a paper trail, this is a similar situation.
Yeah, very much so, right? And to some degree, if we slow it down and think about it, it probably should be, right? You should probably have to have a fair amount of evidence to take away somebody's ability to make their own decisions and to literally force them to stay in a hospital, right? We shouldn't do that lightly. And so sometimes, right, if that requires multiple ED visits or multiple contacts with multiple people, that's valid.
Yep, I agree.
And so I think the question then can become for folks, if you're living in this kind of in-between territory where somebody is having these symptoms, but they don't meet the criteria to be forced to receive treatment, what do we do? And I think that's the place where the relationship can really come into play of, I really care about you. How can I support you through this? Can I bring you to your appointments? What if we went together? If it's a family member, sometimes family members will have like release of information that are kept on file with medical providers. So they can just call a psychiatrist and say, hey, I'm worried. Right. And NAMI has some really great resources related to this too, of how do I support someone in seeking treatment who doesn't want to or isn't aware that they need it. Right? I think sometimes there's a misconception of people have to want treatment, but what if one of the symptoms of the disorder is the fact that you are not aware you need treatment?
When she says NAMI, she means N-A-M-I. So November Alpha Mike Indigo as an organization. And if you go to their website, I think it is NAMI.org. It's chock full of lots of information, good information, resources.
They have really phenomenal stuff. And there's even, they have like a little handout or it's an excerpt from a book called I'm Not Sick, I Don't Need Help, specifically covering how do I help a friend or family member who's in this situation.
As a manager, or owner of a business that may have somebody that's struggling with, I'll just say, reality, I guess what would be your advice? Because you want to be supportive, you still have to run a business. Like, I think it's very reasonable to be very torn about what to do. And are there resources that the business and or employee have that they don't even know they have, or oftentimes don't know they have as part of work comp type? And it may not actually be work comp, but it seems to me like there are certain riders on insurance that are there without you hardly even knowing, that provide resources or money available to go seek help. I'll say help. I don't want to jump right to treatment, but help.
I think the first question I would ask any manager in that scenario is the symptom negatively impacting their work performance? If someone just has a belief, but it doesn't impact work, it's an interesting moment. Do I intervene on this or not? If it's starting to show up in a way where you can see it's impacting work, or it's impacting their ability to care for themselves or their family life, I would argue it's super reasonable to call an emergency contact or a family member and say, hey, I'm concerned. I just want to make sure you're aware. So that would be an option. Sometimes EAPs are available, employee assistance programs, which is totally free help. So you can definitely refer people there. You can always contact county crisis lines, state crisis lines, local crisis lines if you have questions, right? Or even if the person, if you feel like they're having some type of episode at work and truly like maybe cannot function anymore, or you're questioning if they can. I've framed it this way for people before of, would you be open to being assessed in the emergency room so we can sort out what's going on? So I don't immediately jump to, hey, this is a mental health issue. It could be a medication reaction. It could be a medical condition. It could have something to do with pregnancy or post-birth. Like, I'm not going to jump straight to mental health. It's, hey, would you be open to like getting assessed to see if we could get answers?
Yeah, you beat me to it too. What, rightfully so. That it just seems like that's the knee-jerk reaction is a mental health issue. We got to get this person some kind of meds to straighten them out. When it turns out, it's a medical issue, like a physical medical issue.
Right. So I think that would be a reasonable sort of safe way to frame it. We're in a bit of a complicated time if we're talking about resources, because A, people are losing healthcare, and good luck selling someone on getting any type of healthcare if it's going to cost them an arm and a leg. Some of our crisis resources are being defunded or underfunded. And so there's some risk there. And then there's talk about, or I know this has happened, there's been some defunding of the organizations that would enforce mental health parity with health insurance companies. And so it's a little sticky right now sorting through some of those resources. And so I think as a manager or as an owner, if you're having someone who's trying to navigate this, you might have to circle back to it a few times, or maybe even get a little creative about, is there a free clinic somewhere? Is there a family member who could talk to them? Is there a crisis line? Sometimes there's mobile crisis units that can check in with someone if they get a referral, right? Like, there might have to be some digging to even see what's still available.
Yeah, that's good advice.
And then I also think, I guess the other thing I might throw out there is, if someone is managing this or is seeking treatment or some type of intervention for it, it's probably useful to just support the time off or whatever they need to take for that appointment, and maybe not enforce a, like, you have to request time off a week in advance. Like, no, you should probably just go see your doctor now. Like, if they're willing, maybe just like take one for the team and be okay with it.
I guess I don't understand the thought process behind not taking one for the team. But where's the big picture? I mean, come on.
I mean, I think that's a valid question. The thing I might throw out there that I think is so interesting is, we're operating on the assumption that within this conversation, if somebody said, hey, I have an appointment at 10 a.m., I have to go, that the manager would know, or that the person would tell them, oh, by the way, it's because I'm hallucinating. But a lot of people aren't going to disclose that. And so then it's this interesting moment of, so an employee has an appointment at 10 a.m. What if they don't want to tell you what it's about? How are you reacting now?
I am aware of a tech that does work at a shop. They do struggle, and they do have the ability to just go up to somebody, an advisor or the manager or shop foreman, and just say, like, I got to go in now. And away they go.
And that's a really nice arrangement.
Extremely, because now they're loyal. I mean, they're so loyal to that facility and the people there. And I think maybe the first couple times they kind of went like, really going to go golfing, going fishing? But then they see in a day or two or longer, I don't want to make it sound like the changes or alterations or whatever, bounce back, however you want to phrase that, is so immediate, but they notice the benefits of it. And then it's just not questioned anymore.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because with some of these disorders, there can be this thing where these symptoms kind of wax and wane. So for some people, it's seasonal. For some people, it has to do with anniversaries or stress. For some people, it has to do with hormones. And so it can be very variable. And so having the ability to have an arrangement like that and be given the benefit of the doubt is actually really important. And it's even a reasonable accommodation, which is a whole other discussion because that's a legal term. But allowing someone to access medical care is a reasonable accommodation.
If we just twist this the littlest of bit and not make it medical, it's they have atrial fibrillation and such that it is very disruptive. Like, it affects them in a way that they can no longer safely function, be it do the job of whatever on the vehicle, or they really shouldn't be driving. You would probably grant them that time to just drop everything and get their butt up to ER or urgent care, or, you know, find out from their medical practitioner what to do. When it comes to the mental health stuff, all of a sudden that starts to go a little sideways sometimes. It's probably nowadays better than it's ever been in history, but we still have a ways to go.
Well, we do. And you're right. So I've been kind of digging into the numbers on this a little bit. And so it's interesting because we were on an upward trend in terms of people who reporting, yes, I could tell my manager if I was having a mental health issue. Yes, this could be discussed at work. No, I'm not afraid of retaliation. And then since, I think the number I saw was since 2020, those numbers have actually been declining.
Oh, man. Figures.
So we were headed there and now we're dropping again. I think it's still better than it was years and years ago. And the other piece I'd throw out there is we actually know that having access to employment where it's more or less a positive experience, like for the most part, is actually really helpful for recovery. And so it's this massive protective factor if we can make this work somehow that actually supports people in maintaining their well-being.
It's asking a lot for the individual experiencing these to be able to recognize they're experiencing them to seek out help. The chances of that seem really low, the probability. So going through that, I mean, the solution is the crisis hotlines, calling for help. It's all of the things. You're probably not going to know until you're formally diagnosed and maybe in some sort of a, like you said, recovery program or treatment program where now you can kind of, or have a better chance of knowing when things are going off the rails a little bit. I don't know if that's a reasonable question. Is that a reasonable question?
I understand what you're asking. I think it's both. So the thing I've noticed, even as a therapist, is that there is a level of shame and secrecy around this type of symptom that seems to extend beyond other things, right? So when we think about what are the mental health conditions that are being discussed really openly anymore? We're hearing about things like anxiety, depression, ADHD, autism, stuff like that. Even as a therapist, I have had clients who have been experiencing hallucinations for months, who it takes them months to trust me enough to say, hey, this is happening. It's not that they don't know it's happening, and it's not that they don't know it's a problem. It's that there's so much shame and fear around it that they're afraid to ask for help, even when they know it's an issue. So I would say, right, to anyone experiencing this or who's maybe having some beliefs or thoughts where they're like, ooh, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, I don't know, or people react weird when I say it, it is totally valid to ask for help with that. And if for some reason the first person you ask for help from isn't helpful or is shaming about it, then ask someone else. Like, keep asking until someone provides a meaningful level of support. So there's that piece of it. And then even, right, asking early. So the first time it happens and not waiting for months, right? Or I think about postpartum. That's a particularly dangerous time if this type of symptomology is happening, which is rare, to be clear. Like, it's very rare. And when it does happen, it can get bad and get worse really fast. If you're postpartum and this is just starting, seek help right away. And there's a lot more support out there now around that time period and the mental health stuff that can happen there. So it is reasonable to say, like, hey, if you're aware of this, ask for help early and keep asking until you get it.
We know this profession is overwhelmingly male. And I mean, not that it's so important, but I guess overwhelmingly, by sheer statistics, heterosexual male. Meaning they probably have a significant other and have families. So now their significant other, whoever they're having a child with, seems to be displaying these symptoms. How would one go about, A, verifying that that's indeed the case and you're not jumping to conclusions because you listened to a podcast or watched a documentary or a TV show or something? And also then, if need be, to get help without burning down the relationship or causing a major rift. Although, depending on the situation, that might be what needs to be done anyways, or at least risked.
Again, I think it has to do with how you frame it. So the first step isn't, hey, are you hallucinating? Like, don't do that.
Are you hallucinating or what?
Yeah, do not do that. Okay. Here's what you do. Hey, I really love you. The baby's been up all night. What if I stayed home with you today? Can I help you? Do you want to take a bath? How about a nap? Do you want someone to come stay? I know this is a lot. That's your first step. And then maybe introduce the conversation of, hey, how do you feel like you're adjusting? How are you feeling? Am I showing up for you in a way that's helpful? You can even ask, right? When is your next appointment with your doctor? Is there anything you're hoping to discuss with them? Would you like me to come with you? If they're sharing things with you and it sounds like something is happening, maybe say, hey, what do you think about trying to get in sooner and I came with you? I could help with the baby. And so it becomes this collaborative thing and not a, you need to get it figured out.
The first one you mentioned that's really good, I hate to use the word subtle, but really kind of subtle way to ensure safety and without accusing anything, like, I don't know, I don't think you're right in the head. I don't know if I trust you at home with the kid in it or the baby while I'm at work. That's a much better way. And then more observation time, more, I guess, trust building too. Leading to, like you're saying, the next and the next and the next. So that's really smart.
Well, and it builds the relationship, right? The reality is, even for women who are experiencing some type of postpartum symptomology, they don't want to harm their baby. And if they're having thoughts of that, they are terrified by it. It is so, so rare for that to actually progress into harm or for it to be something that that parent wants. And so again, right, we're not shaming, we're not blaming, we're not criticizing. It's very much, how do I support you? And how would I take the pressure off?
Margaret, you are a presenter and have been a presenter now for some classes to the automotive industry, one rather recently. And then I think you're going to be down at ASTA in next month.
Yes.
What are the topics you're teaching there or presenting about?
Yes. So next month I'm at ASTA talking about mental health. It's a 4-hour course. We're going to go over business impacts. We're going to talk about different mental health disorders and how those show up. We're going to talk about recognizing them in yourselves and other people. And then we're going to kind of answer those business questions about, as a manager or owner, how do you support an employee who is struggling with some type of mental health concern? And then we're going to go through all the like seeking help stuff. So that's next month. And then in November, I am at Super Saturday and Apex SEMA.
Wow. Same subject or do you have another subject?
So Super Saturday, it's a shortened mental health class, 2 hours. And then there's like a round table thing for owner managers I'll be a part of. And then Apex SEMA, again, a 2-hour mental health thing, and then a 2-hour working with different generations course. So bridging that gap.
You said something that piqued my interest about it builds the relationship. And I think that would be a very, very interesting topic for anyone in a business, but especially somebody that's, you know, face to face at that point of contact most of the time, that can learn means of communicating that builds rather than tears down or pulls it apart or weakens the relationship between the client and either that person or the facility. So that's a very intriguing idea to me.
That would be fun. If I ever build that course, if anyone ever sees it, we're also going to talk about how to give feedback in a way that builds a relationship too, because I love that.
I need that. That's what I need.
So somebody needs to book me for that course so Matt can take it.
Yeah, I'm going to be in front row, center, right next to the aisle.
Okay, good. I'm going to count on it.
Yes, I'm going to probably ask if I could record it so I can play it back over and over. But yes, I need that.
Don't we all?
I really, really want to thank you again for being on. I mean, every time I think we could just talk for 2-3 hours, no problem. This is fascinating subjects. I have other subjects or topic ideas that constantly pop into my head that would be very interesting to talk about. And I mean, I don't know. You've probably heard the rumor. Sometimes scheduling can be rough with me.
I'd probably be on your podcast more.
Probably.
If scheduling was easier.
Now the emails are flying in like, Matt, get your act together, which they're right. I need to get my act together.
If anybody has problems, they can call me.
But yeah, this has been Margaret Light. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist. She is also the, I guess, president or owner, ruler of the Equilibrium Therapy Services, namely in Minnesota, right?
Minnesota and Wisconsin now.
Nice. Excellent. So Minnesota, Wisconsin, if you're seeking, I mean, I'm just on the level, somebody to talk to and help point out your blind spots, it is invaluable to have somebody that is looking out for you, but not necessarily like friends or biased, if that makes sense. And yeah, it's invaluable.
Thank you for having me back. This is good.
Anytime. Absolutely anytime. And I would just like to thank our sponsors, Napa Auto Tech Training and Pico Technology. I'd also like to thank the Aftermarket Radio Network and even Tracy for helping get this up and going so that Margaret and I could record this. Until next time, take care.
You've been listening to Matt Fonslow diagnosing the aftermarket A to Z on the Aftermarket Radio Network. Follow Matt on your favorite listening app. He's very interested in what you have to say. Let him know what you'd like him to cover and come on the show. Matt is all for advancing the aftermarket. Find Matt Fonslow on social media and connect or on aftermarketradionetwork.com.